We read in the prophet Isaiah that whoever walks in darkness and has no light shining for him, let him trust in the name of the Lord. Let him lean on his God. The people that walked in darkness have seen a great light. Those who live in a land of deep shadow, a light has shone. You have made their gladness greater. You have made their joy increase. For they rejoice in your presence as men rejoice at the time of harvest. For the yoke that was weighing on him and the bar across his shoulders, the rod of the oppressor, these you break. And we see in these passages from Isaiah and in a number of other places in the prophets where salvation is pictured for us as a light shining in darkness, a light piercing the darkness, dispelling the shadows and the clouds and the gloom. And in the healing ministry, we begin to realize that this is not simply a symbolic image, but for many people, walking in darkness is very real. There seems to be certain people whose lives are almost spent in clouds of gloom, in sadness, sorrow, and despair. And two types of problems, two types of people that seem to live in these clouds would be those who live with self-pity and those caught up in depression. And although these are two different problems, I see them alike in this sense that both of them, in fact, seem to be people who live under a cloud. There's a gloom all around them. And in many ways, they're somewhat connected. That people who have self-pity can eventually move into a mode of depression. And people who are depressed can very often end up caught in a morass of self-pity. We'll talk about them separately and then tie them together at the end. We speak about ministering to these problems. The self-pitying person seems to be caught up in a whole morass of misfortune. It's what I call the poor me syndrome. It's a person who groans and who moans with that self-pitying whine that everything is wrong, everything is always wrong, everything always happens to me, and no one loves me. I'm all alone. I'm lonely. And everything in my life is misfortune, bad luck, sadness, failure, brokenness, and sorrow. And in some ways, the lament that no one loves me is almost self-fulfilling. Because this person so often seeks out a sympathetic ear and a shoulder to lean on and cry on and pours out a whole litany of woes and sorrows, that in fact, very quickly, people begin to avoid him or her. People begin to hide, cringe when he comes. And so this person very quickly finds that friends are indeed very few, and no one does love him, or at least no one's able to, because they can't break through the cycle of self-pity that feeds upon itself. And I think there are three things that I see in this person with self-pity. One is that this person is actually a prisoner to the past, and that he or she looks back over his life or her life, and there's a whole accumulated weight of past problems and hurts and misfortunes and bad luck and failure. And it's all accumulated and piled up, and it's a crushing weight. A prisoner to the past. And because the past has been so filled with misfortune, or at least it's read that way, that in the present, and this is the second point, the person begins to dwell upon the negative and takes hold of every sorrow and sadness and begins to magnify them way out of proportion. Magnify them to the point where the negatives in life begin to block out the more positive elements. And then what is negative begins to color one's whole perception of reality. The whole perception of reality is colored by the problems and the sorrows and the hurts, real or imagined. And once they're dwelt on, they get magnified. And the more they're magnified, the more they color. Then thirdly, there is almost, in some of these people at least, a need for self-depreciation. There is a need to, as it were, prove how bad things are. To tell people about the latest misfortune, the latest sorrow, the latest bit of bad luck. Somehow, and I'm not too sure if this is sound psychology, but I see almost a tinge of masochism, a need to depreciate the self, and almost to degrade the self by dwelling on how unlucky I am, how bad off I am. Now, this problem is fairly difficult to deal with, fairly difficult to minister to, because the person that we're dealing with seems to feel that misfortune and sadness is his lot. It's his due. And has got into a rut and to the point where it's almost impossible to think positively, to decide against such sadness and sorrow, and begin to accept the love of God and to celebrate the presence of God in his life, to realize every gift and glory of God that is all around him, and begin to truly rejoice. It's very difficult to minister. It's very time-consuming, and it requires much patience, but it is possible. But let us go on now to depression. Depression is similar to the self-pity, as I said, in that it's as though a cloud of gloom or sadness seemed to hang over the person and to crush that person under its weight. The will of that person who is depressed actually seems to be broken by uncontrollable sadness, by despair. And if the person with self-pity is prisoner to his past, I see the person who is depressed is prisoner to the future. That is almost locked out of the future. Because a person who is truly depressed looks to the tasks of everyday life, the tasks and the needs and the demands of tomorrow, and sees it as totally impossible and absolutely overwhelming. Every task and every simple duty and responsibility is magnified to the point where it becomes an impossible task and an overwhelming responsibility. And so for a truly depressed person, just getting out of bed in the morning requires almost what it would seem to be superhuman effort. To do the dishes, to take care of the house for a housewife, to take care of her children. Somehow, what is a simple task and done without thinking to other people, is for the person who is depressed, so absolutely overwhelming as to seem impossible. And so they become locked more and more into their own despair. Almost impossible for them to even hope or imagine a new day or time of joy. And if self-pity seeks to share its sadness, depression seeks an almost self-imposed isolation. And the depressed person becomes more and more locked in on himself or herself, isolated, cut off, unwilling, and in some ways maybe unable to reach out and to break through the isolation and to break out of the gloom and the cloud of sadness that surrounds him. And demands of people who are well-meaning to snap out of it and to begin to go about one's daily routine and to do things that to everyone else seem so simple, such as wash the dishes or get dressed or do the housework, seems so impossible to the one who is depressed. And so demanding one to snap out of it only creates more guilt in the depressed person. And the guilt increases the depression. And so the cloud of gloom increases and thickens. And the weight of the depression, the sorrow, the sadness, and the despair only increases and weighs more heavily. And yet I think for both the person suffering from self-pity and the person suffering from depression, there is indeed healing. They both need healing love. And for both cases, there is a special demand put upon the minister. Because in both cases, the decision to be healed is almost too much to make. It's so difficult for them to raise their heads and to look beyond the sadness and the cloud. And it is as though their vision of tomorrow has been colored, saddened. The cloud is so thick they can't see beyond it or think positively. And yet we know that God's will is for joy. God would definitely seem to desire healing for these people. So often in Scripture he enjoins us to rejoice, to be glad, to celebrate. And one of the fruits of the Spirit and the mark of a true Christian is that there be joy. And for the depressed, for the sorrowing and the sad, for the self-pitying, joy seems almost like an impossible gift, beyond the realm or horizon of their experience or capacity to receive. And yet I think the truth is that the love of God and the healing love of God, ministered in love and gentleness, can pierce any darkness and can bring not a further burden of guilt, but understanding. It can bring security. It can bring new hope and love. And from that hope and that love, there can spring forth joy. Now the minister of healing to these people must know that the healing cannot be forced. But especially in these cases, it takes time to mature. The healing in these cases takes time to develop. And the minister will allow the healing to develop in its own time. It will not force it before its time. The minister of healing has to be gentle, tender, and never demand more of a response than can be given. And yet at the same time, the minister always has to seek a response in proportion to what is possible. The burden of the ministry falls especially on the minister, more than on the person to be ministered to. The weight of faith, confidence in the Lord, and quiet trust belongs more to the minister than to the depressed or the self-pitying. And yet there always needs to be that balance, that what the sick person can give, he does give. What the sick person is able to achieve, he or she does achieve. There has to be some positive steps made by the sick person, but never more should be demanded of them than what they can in fact give at the time. And then the prayer for healing, for depression and self-pity, has to be positive, vivid, uplifting. It should look into the future to see tomorrow as a new day, present a picture of hope, of joy, of new life, of vibrant expectancy, and so begin to raise the eyes of the depressed person, however slowly, and look beyond the cloud that encircles and enshrouds them, begins to spark hope. They begin to take those small, quiet steps towards recovery, towards recovering their own life and receiving joy. And as we pray for that person who is depressed or suffering in the gloom of self-pity, we see that person as though covered by a cloud. We see the person almost enshrouded in a cloud or a gloom, a covering of sadness and sorrow. And we see that cloud as thick, as heavy, dark, almost as though it were a mist encircling the person and covering him. We see it as thick. We see it as heavy. We see it as one that weighs down upon the person. And if the minister pictures that person in that way, in the vivid imagination, he can suddenly begin to understand why that person is so depressed, why that person is so caught up in self-pity. And for the person who is being ministered to, that picture of himself or herself so shrouded over, so covered in mist and darkness, is a very easy one to imagine, because it's the image of their life. And then we move beyond that. We just see a ray of divine light shining on the person. And yet that ray of light doesn't at once break through the cloud and touch the heart of the person, but rather it shines upon the cloud. And you understand that the light of Christ and the light of his joy and his peace cannot break through into the heart of that person because of the cloud of gloom. And so the light of Christ shines upon the cloud itself. And then just as a fog dissipates under the light of the sun, you picture that cloud dissipating under the light of Christ. You see it slowly begin to dissolve, to be absorbed into the light, to dissipate, disappear, to lessen, to lighten, so it is no longer so thick, no longer so dark, but begins slowly, slowly, slowly to lighten and to lift and to disappear. And finally, the light of the Lord shines through and pierces the darkness and touches the heart of the suffering person. And then Jesus is beside that person, and the light is coming from his heart, the Sacred Heart of Jesus, and shining into the heart of the suffering person. And Jesus speaks to that person of understanding, and how he knows, how he really knows the hurts and the sorrow. And yet he says, I give you promise of hope, that if you trust me and let me work, there will be new life. You can see Jesus' face glowing, the smile of joy upon his face, and you know that you can trust him and that you'd accept that promise from him that there will be new life. and he takes from his heart the gift of joy, and he places it upon your heart. And he says the day will come when you can truly rejoice and be glad. For the world will have new vitality for you. The colors will be bright and vivid. You will go about your daily life with joy and singing and gladness in your heart, with psalms of hope and joy upon your lips and praise within your spirit. And then the suffering person takes that gift of joy and holds on to it tight, and knows that the promise of God will not fail, but the day will come, and the day will come soon, when there will be new hope, when there will be new joy, rejoicing and gladness. And so that person accepts that gift, and the Lord blesses him. The Lord imparts his blessing, and it is accepted, and his work begins.